AIDS brings a response from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to AIDS Lost Voices with me, William Hampson. In this series, we journey through the decades to explore how Britain reported on the AIDS pandemic. We'll delve into the newspaper archives from the 80s, 90s and noughties, unearthing individual stories that reveal the human experiences behind the headlines. Join me as we seek to understand the complexities of a crisis that reshaped lives and challenged societal perceptions. Ready? Let's go.
Acquired immune deficiency syndrome is a terrifying and mysterious disease, and it's killing a lot of people.
AIDS was discovered first in young homosexual men. There is no cure, and it is often fatal.
The airline steward, named Gaetan Dugas, patient zero, one of the first cases of AIDS, the first person identified as a major transmitter of the disease.
The myth of patient zero has been shattered. The Quebec man thought to be at the epicenter of the rise of the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s has had his name cleared. CTV's Brian Dunson.
Gaetan Dugas was born on the 19th of February 1952 and was adopted into a large family in L'Ancienne-Lorette, Quebec, Canada. Gaetan initially trained and worked as a hairdresser before transitioning to a role as an air steward with Air Canada, after changes in attitudes allowed men to enter this predominantly female profession. One of Gaetan's earliest appearances in the press was when his name was printed in the American newspaper, the Albany Democrat Herald, on the 23rd of April 1973. The newspaper detailed Gaetan's appearance in district court a few days earlier, on the 20th of April 1973, at the age of 21, for a traffic offence, described as, quote, following too close, end quote, suggesting that Gaetan may have been tailgating, a situation that could have risen from inattention or impatience, perhaps being late for work, or maybe Gaetan attempting to get the attention of a handsome driver. The court ultimately dismissed the charge. Thankfully, that's all Gaetan had to endure when it came to unwanted press attention, as he didn't make headlines across the entire world until 3 years after his death, on the 30th of March 1984, as a result of AIDS-related complications. Gaetan was only 32 years old. Then, in October 1987, a single announcement reverberated through the global press. Gaetan Dugas was designated as Patient Zero, a term that would be forever tied to the AIDS epidemic's narrative, not only in North America, but the entire world. This assertion, claiming that Gaetan was the originator of the virus's spread, rapidly gained traction, with numerous newspapers enthusiastically echoing the sensationalism of the story. The archives of these publications are replete with articles that reflect both a frantic push for readership and a profound misunderstanding of the complexities surrounding the epidemic. In the United Kingdom, the Daily Telegraph wasted no time, headlining on the 7th of October 1987 with Patient Zero, the man who spread AIDS, is named. Spurred by journalist Charles Lawrence's sensational report from New York City, where they report. A French-Canadian airline steward from Montreal is now believed to have been the, quote, patient zero, end quote, who started the spread of AIDS among homosexuals. Gaetan Dugas worked for a Canadian airline and is known to have had affairs with the first two identified AIDS patients in New York. He is also known to have had relations with at least four of the first 19 people who succumbed to the disease in Los Angeles. Another four of the 19 had sex with one of his lovers, and at least 17 of the first 248 cases reported in the United States by 1982 were linked to Dugas. Dugas died of AIDS in 1984, aged 28. Psych. He is thought to have become infected through sexual contacts with Africans in Europe. He was traced by medical researchers from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, several years before he died, and is said to have continued with his promiscuous homosexual habits even after being warned of the consequences. It has been known for some time that AIDS researchers had tracked down America's first reported cases, but the identity of, quote, patient zero, end quote, has been reported for the first time in a book called And the Band Played On, People, Politics and the AIDS Epidemic. The author is a San Francisco homosexual author, Randy Schultz. Dugas, says Mr. Schultz, was so promiscuous that he found it difficult to recall all his lovers named in his own address book when being interviewed by doctors. He used his job, which took him all over North America and Europe, to find new sex partners. Mr. Schultz writes, quote, lovers were like suntans to him. They would be so wonderful, so sexy for a few days, and then fade, end quote. Oh, gosh. Anyhow, what was it Randy Schultz had written in his book, and the band played on, politics, people, and the AIDS epidemic? Well, virtually every newspaper across the United States and Canada serialised the book. Well, mainly the parts about Gaétan Dugas. Canada's The Times and Transcript newspaper serialised the book in six parts, two of which focused on Gaétan. The first on the 21st of November 1987, where they shared. San Francisco, June 29, 1980. Quote, I am the prettiest one, end quote. It had been the standing joke. Gaétan Dugas would walk into a gay bar, scan the crowd and announce to his friends, quote, I am the prettiest one, end quote. Usually, his friends had to agree. He was right. Gaétan was the man everyone wanted, the ideal for this community, at this time and in this place. His sandy hair fell boyishly over his forehead, his mouth easily curled into an inviting smile. Americans tumbled for his soft Quebecuous accent and his sensual magnetism. There was no place the 28-year-old airline steward would rather have boys fall for him than in San Francisco. Throughout the city, thousands of gay men crowded into giant disco parties that became the staple of the weekend-long Gay Freedom Day parade celebration. The hottest and hunkiest, Gaétan knew, would be among the 4,000 streaming to the Chic Galleria Design Centre, where the party was just starting, when the steward and his friend arrived. Every corner of the lobby and the five-storey atrium was crammed with men pulsing to the synthesised rhythms of disco music. Here, Gaétan could satisfy his voracious sexual appetite with the beautiful California men he liked so much. He returned from every stroll down Castro Street with a pocket full of matchbook covers and napkins that were crowded with addresses and phone numbers. Here, swaying and stomping to the music, Gaétan was complete in his element. He felt strong and vital. He didn't feel like he had cancer at all. That was what the doctor had said after cutting that bump from his face. Gaétan had wanted the small purplish spot removed to satisfy his vanity. The doctor had wanted it for a biopsy. Weeks later, the report came back from New York City, and the Toronto specialist told Gaétan that he had Kaposi sarcoma, a bizarre skin cancer that hardly anybody got. Maybe that explained why his lymph nodes had been swollen for a year. Gaétan hadn't told friends until June, after the biopsy. He was terrified at first, but he consoled himself with the knowledge that you can beat cancer. He had created a life in which he could have everything and everyone he wanted. He'd figure out a way around this cancer too. In the United States, unexplained maladies from a mysterious new syndrome would be traced back to 1979. It was on a balmy September day in 1979 that Rick Welikoff, a gay New York schoolteacher, had been sent to Dr. Linda Loberstein for blood studies. She duly noted the generalized rash that resisted treatment and the enlarged lymph nodes all over his body. Loberstein surveyed the man and assumed he had lymph cancer. Later, a dermatologist told Linda that the man's rash was Kaposi sarcoma. Given the rarity of the cancer, Linda decided to follow Rick closely and mention him to several other doctors. 2 weeks after she first saw the schoolteacher, she got a phone call from a colleague at the Veterans Administration Hospital, a few blocks south of New York University Medical Center on First Avenue. Quote, "You're not going to believe it, but there's another one down here," he said. Loberstein quickly went to the VA hospital to visit the other Kaposi sarcoma patient who seemed very similar to Rick. The man was much more handsome, to be sure. After all, he was a model. But he was a 37-year-old homosexual and, in the strangest twist, the pair shared mutual friends. It was uncanny. Among their acquaintances, they said, was a dreamy blonde flight attendant from Canada. He had an unusual name that stuck in Linda's mind. Quote, "Gaétan. You should talk to Gaétan," end quote. The first two gay men to be diagnosed with Kaposi sarcoma in New York City told Linda Loberstein in 1979, quote, "You should talk to Gaétan because he's got this rash too," end quote. New York City, October the 31st, 1980. Halloween had, for generations, stood out as the singularly gay holiday. The gay hotspots came alive with masquerades and special parties. At the Flamingo, one of the choicest private clubs where A-list guys discoed until dawn, Jack now enjoyed the revelry and tried to pick out friends behind the costumes. His boyfriend, Paul Popham, was out of town, which made it all the more tantalising when Jack saw a familiar face. A blonde smiled back in a particularly winning way, and before long, Jack and Gaétan Dugas slipped away from the crowd into the night. Orange County, California, Thanksgiving Day, 1980. Canadian winters were so tedious that Gaétan Dugas was overjoyed at the invitation to spend Thanksgiving weekend in Southern California. The new object of Gaétan's affections, a hairdresser, was equally thrilled. Normally, the hairdresser was content to cruise the Boom Boom Room in Laguna Beach. His trip to the 8709 Club in West Hollywood had been only his second or third time at a bathhouse, and he'd hooked this gorgeous airline steward who was coming back for seconds, maybe even thirds. What a wonderful weekend they'd have. The baths weren't so bad after all, he thought. Toronto, July 1981. When Gaétan Dugas saw the first story about Kaposi's sarcoma, he researched the best American centres for treatment and made a beeline for New York University, where Dr. Alvin Friedemann Kine and Linda Loberstein were seeing the most KS patients. He was going to beat this, he told his friends. His Canadian doctors hadn't done anything for him. Within days, he had lined up an appointment in NYU, New York University. New York, July 1981. Gaétan moved back to Montreal when he finished his chemotherapy. He had taken a leave from Air Canada and decided to adopt a more leisurely life, using airline passes he still held to do the coastal hopping he enjoyed so much. He returned to New York University once a month for more treatments. When his hair began falling out, he simply shaved his head so nobody would notice. His Yul Brynner look was quite attractive. As he travelled between San Francisco, Los Angeles, Vancouver, Toronto and New York, he realised that if he kept to bathhouses where the lights were turned down low, nobody would ask him about those embarrassing purple spots. He was still the prettiest one. Dr. Mary Guinan had joined that Kaposi's sarcoma task force at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta as soon as the first case of pneumonia and cancer were reported among gay men in New York and Los Angeles. The CDC was planning an elaborate case control study on the disease that fall, but Guinan had volunteered to go into the field now to see if a preliminary study of all the living, quote, gay cancer, end quote, patients might yield some clues as to what was behind this thing. Dr. Guinan felt helpless and frightened. This was the meanest disease she had ever encountered. She strained to consider every possible nuance of these people's lives. The CDC, she knew, needed to work every hypothesis into the case study control. Had they been to Vietnam? Maybe this was a delayed effect of Agent Orange. Did their grandmother ever have cancer? Maybe this was some genetic fluke only appearing now, or perhaps it was some health food fad gone awry. Several of the cases, it turned out, weren't gay men at all, but drug addicts. At the CDC, there was a reluctance to believe that intravenous drug users might be wrapped into this epidemic, and the New York physicians also seemed obsessed with the gay angle, Dr. Guinan thought. Quote, he says he's not a homosexual, but he must be, end quote, doctors would confide to her. There was an odd coincidence, Dr. Guinan had noted. She walked in on one of her interview subjects as he was stepping out of the shower in his room in the ambulatory care apartments at New York University. Dr. Guinan was embarrassed at first, but he was so charming with his soft French accent that she got on with her questions. He had been quite sexually active, he confided rather proudly. The patient, a French-Canadian airline steward, had a sex life much like that of other gay men Dr. Guinan had interviewed. Including his nights at the baths, he figured he had 250 sexual contacts a year. He'd been involved in gay life for about 10 years and easily had had 2,500 sexual partners. In fact, one of his old tricks, flames, Jack now was in New York Hospital with something strange right now, Gaétan Dugas said. Dr. Guinan later mentioned the conversation to the task force, but nobody made too much of it, even though Gaétan's comment about sleeping with Jack now was the first time two victims of the new epidemic were ever linked sexually. Because Gaétan was Canadian, the first person in his country to be diagnosed with AIDS, he was lost to immediate follow-up by the CDC. The case control study included only those in the United States. Los Angeles, February 1982. Doctors William Darrow and David Auerbach had spent another exhausting day attempting to track the reported connections between the first case of gay cancer and gay pneumonia in Los Angeles, and they were supposed to be in Orange County that night for one more interview. The two diseases were now grouped under one name, GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. Dr. Darrow, a longtime veteran of the CDC, had worked on the case control study the year before. No single cause of the epidemic had been identified. Increasingly, it appeared that GRID might be caused by a single infectious agent, but until the CDC had proof, there could not be a push to start investigations into the specific cause, much less a cure or vaccine. Dr. Darrow had flown to Los Angeles from Atlanta when the rumour of sexual links between many of the GRID cases reached the CDC. He and Dr. Auerbach, a CDC field representative at the LA County Department of Health Services, were now working on an intriguing lead they had come across regarding a French-Canadian airline steward. His name had come up 3 times in interviews, but all of the reports came from lovers of deceased patients, not from anybody who had actually slept with him. The ailing businessman they were to interview led them through to his living room to a picnic table in the kitchen. The man was suffering from KS, Kaposi sarcoma. It didn't take him long to get to the point. Quote, "I bet I know how I got this thing," he said. "I had sex with this attractive guy I met at a bathhouse. He came over and spent the weekend. He came back to Los Angeles for a few more weekends, even stayed here for Thanksgiving. And then I never saw him again. He gave me hepatitis, and I bet he gave me this new disease too."
So he excused himself, he went into his bedroom, and he came back with a big smile on his face. "I've got it, I've got it, I've got it. Here's his name. I had sex with him on Thanksgiving, 8709 Club, and afterwards I came down with hepatitis. And then he came back in December, I had sex with him again, and I bet that's when I got this disease that I've got now. What's his name?" He says, "Here it is."
That was Dr. Darrow speaking on the 2019 documentary film Killing Patient Zero. Now, you're going to hear more about that documentary film a little bit later, but Dr. Darrow, top guy. Anyhow, back to the article. Finally, they had a live person telling them he had sex with this flight attendant. It was, Dr. Darrow said later, one of the most significant moments of the epidemic. The connections started falling into place. Of the first 19 cases of GRID in Los Angeles, 4 had had sex with Gaetan Dugas. Another 4 cases, meanwhile, had gone to bed with people who had had sex with Dugas, establishing sexual links with 9 of the 19 Los Angeles cases. Moreover, the lines bore out fears about the virus having a long latency period. For example, the Orange County man Dr. Darrow and Dr. Auerbach had interviewed did not show symptoms until August 1981, some 10 months after Gaetan spent the weekend with him on Thanksgiving in 1980. Another Los Angeles man found his first Kaposi sarcoma lesions 13 months after he had slept with the French-Canadian during a trip Gaetan made to Southern California in February 1980. Atlanta, March 1982. The CDC reported 285 cases of GRID in 17 states. Half the cases were in New York City and a quarter of the cases were in California. 5 other nations, all in Europe, also reported cases of the disease. New York City, March 1982. Gaetan Dugas seemed quite pleased with himself as he rattled off his sexual exploits to Dr. Bill Darrow. "All my beautiful lovers," the airline steward seemed to be saying, rather proudly. He paused for a moment before asking a question that Dr. Darrow thought was too naive a tone. Quote, "Why were you interested in all these people?" End quote. Dr. Darrow replied, quote, "Some of them have been diagnosed with this immune deficiency and some haven't. We want to find out why some get the disease and others don't." End quote. Gaetan's face dropped. He looked stunned, as if a new and horrible idea had only now taken residence in his mind. Quote, "You mean I may have been passing this around?" he asked. Quote, "Yeah," Dr. Darrow said, surprised that Gaetan hadn't thought of it before. Quote, "You may be passing it around, or you might have gotten it from someone else," end quote. The last part of Dr. Darrow's comment, it turned out, would probably have been best left unsaid, given Gaetan's subsequent activities. Oh, gosh, you know, I don't know how you feel about it, but for me, it just makes me feel a little bit sick inside that you've got a gay author, Randy Schultz, who's kind of exposing a fellow gay who's got this horrible disease. And, you know, this book comes out in 1987. So it's like, you know, HIV AIDS by this time is well and truly understood. And he still went along with this. It's just, anyhow, leaving us on that little bit of a cliffhanger. It does continue in the same newspaper, the Times and Transcript, two days later, on the 23rd of November 1987, where we get to hear part two. Gaetan was the link in the spread of AIDS. Oh God. University of California, San Francisco, April the 1st, 1982. Speaking smoothly in his charming French accent, the young man seemed the personification of all things debonair. Marcus Conant, a doctor at the University of California San Francisco Medical Center, was amazed that the airline steward had been diagnosed with Kaposi's sarcoma for almost 2 years already. He still looked healthy. He still exuded a vibrant sensuality. Gaetan Dugas was proud that his cancer had not progressed. He was going to beat this thing, he insisted. He just wanted Dr. Conant to check him out and make sure everything was under control. After the examination, as Gaetan was pulling on his stylish shirt, Dr. Conant mentioned that Gaetan should stop having sex. Gaetan looked wounded, but his voice betrayed a fierce edge of bitterness. Quote, "Of course, I'm going to have sex," he told Dr. Conant. "Nobody's proven to me that you can spread cancer," end quote. Gaetan cut Dr. Conant's rebuttal short. Quote, "Somebody gave this thing to me," he said. "I'm not going to give up sex," end quote. Atlanta, June 1982. By the time Dr. Bill Darrow's research was done, he had established sexual links between 40 patients in 10 cities. At the centre of the cluster diagram was Gaetan Dugas, marked on the chart as patient zero of the grid epidemic. His role truly was remarkable. At least 40 of the 248 gay men diagnosed with grid in the United States as of April the 12th, 1982, either had had sex with Gaetan Dugas or had had sex with somebody who had. The links sometimes were extended for many generations of sexual contract, giving frightening insight into how rapidly the epidemic had spread before anyone knew about it. Before one of Gaetan's Los Angeles boyfriends came down with pneumocystis, for example, he had had sex with another Angelino who came down with Kaposi's sarcoma and with a Florida man who contracted both Kaposi's and the pneumonia. The Los Angeles contact, in turn, cavorted with two other Los Angeles men who later came down with Kaposi's, one of whom infected another Southern California man who was suffering from KS. The Floridian, meanwhile, had sex with a Texan who got Kaposi's sarcoma, a second Florida man who got pneumocystis, and two Georgia men, one of whom got pneumocystis and another who soon found the skin lesions of KS. Before finding the lesions, however, the Georgian had sex with a Pennsylvania man who later came down with both pneumocystis and KS. From just one tryst with Gaetan, therefore 11 grid cases could be connected. Oh my God, what bullshit. Oh, it just stinks, doesn't it? I don't even know how they could have believed this at the time. All right, start again. From just one tryst with Gaetan, therefore 11 grid cases could be connected. Altogether, Gaetan could be connected to 9 of the first 19 cases of grid in Los Angeles. 23 in... I can't, this is just so stupid. It's just pure bullshit. All right, I'll start again. From just one try... I'm reading this under protest. Although it's important to realise what had gone on at the time and how far we've come, especially as you'll learn later on in the episode, with scientific advances. Anyhow, right, and common fucking sense. Gaetan could be connected to 9 of the first 19 cases of grid in Los Angeles, 22 in New York City, and 9 patients in 8 other North American cities. The Los Angeles Cluster Study, as it became known, offered powerful evidence that grid not only was transmissible, but the work of a single infectious agent. A CDC statistician calculated the odds on whether it could be coincidental that 40 of the first 248 gay men to get grid might all have had sex with either the same man or men sexually linked to him. The statistician figured that the chance did not approach zero. It was zero. By mid-1982, the epidemic was spreading faster than the official pronouncements indicated. Science was not working at its best, accepting new information with an unbiased eye and beginning appropriate investigations. The handful of scientists who ignored their elders' advice and worked on the newly christened AIDS epidemic found themselves not only struggling against a baffling disease, but against the indifference of science, government, mass media, most gay leaders and public health officials. Vancouver, British Columbia, June 1982. Gaetan Dugas confided only to a few friends that he was the, quote, Orange County connection, end quote, as the study became known because of Gaetan's role in linking the New York, Los Angeles and Orange County cases. Though on leave from Air Canada, the 30-year-old flight attendant still had the passes that allowed him to fly all over the world for virtually nothing. He loved the travel, but he had decided to settle in San Francisco. They had an interferon program at their GRID clinic, and besides, he had always wanted to live there. It was at this time that rumors began on Castro Street in San Francisco about a strange guy at the 8th and Howard Bathhouse, a blonde with a French accent. He would have sex with you, turn up the lights in the cubicle and point out his Kaposi's sarcoma lesions. Quote, "I've got gay cancer," he'd say. "I'm going to die, and so are you," end quote. Oh, have you ever heard the biggest bullshit? I can smell the bullshit from here. Oh, man, whatever. Oh, who on earth in their right mind would say that? Oh, it's just ridiculous. San Francisco, November 1982. Gaetan Dugas examined himself closely in the steamy mirror of San Francisco's most popular bathhouse. How does he know this? He stood back to give his body another appraisal. Oh. He was 30 years old, an age he never thought he would make, but he was triumphing. He was living in San Francisco, where he had always wanted to live. He had outlived all the doctor's predictions and felt quite nice. Thank you. 2.5 years after he was told that the small purplish spot near his ear was Kaposi's sarcoma. True, he was a bit more tired these days and sometimes breathing came hard. He would win, nevertheless, and enjoy his evenings here at the baths. Of course, the doctors at the CDC might scream at him for being there. They were bothering his old boyfriends with phone calls and nosy questions, and they were bothering him too with all their warnings that he might be spreading this thing. Everybody knew you couldn't catch cancer. He wanted to see proof. Besides, defiantly, somebody gave this to him. Gaetan peered down the long hallway of cubicles, some with their doors open. Gaetan made his choice and edged into the small cubicle and waited for the ritual nod that indicated he would be welcome. Without a word, the assignation was set. Gaetan pushed the door shut. Afterwards, the young man rolled over on his back for a cigarette. Gaetan Dugas reached up for the lights. He then made a point of eyeing the purple lesions on his chest. Quote, "Gay cancer," he said, almost as if he were talking to himself. "Maybe you'll get it too." End quote. Oh. No comment. It gets your book out there, I guess. Oh, I smell bullshit. San Francisco, December 1982. The stranger grabbed Gaetan Dugas' arm and wouldn't let go. Quote, "I know who you are and what you're doing," the man said. "You'd better leave town if you know what's good for you," end quote. Volunteers at the Kaposi Sarcoma Foundation helpline, who had long been apprised of Gaetan's bathhouse escapades, were now hearing that a group of gay men had decided to drive the, quote, "Orange County connection," end quote, out of town for so purposely spreading his disease. Gaetan tore away from the menacing face and said something defiant before ambling back down to Castro Street. "These people are hysterical about AIDS," he told himself. It was around then that he confided to Canadian friends that he was thinking of moving back to Vancouver. Vancouver, British Columbia, March 1983. When Gaetan Dugas' best friend moved from Toronto back to Vancouver, everybody was talking about Gaetan as, quote, "the Orange County connection," end quote, going out to bars and having sex with people. Gaetan's sexual prowling had reached near legendary proportions since then. He made little effort to conceal his medial problems, casually rolling up his sleeves as he quaffed beers at pubs despite the lesions on his forearms. According to one story, one tryst of Gaetan's was so furious when he heard that Gaetan had AIDS that he tracked the former airline steward down to confront him. By the time they were done talking, Gaetan had charmed the man back into bed. The friend from Toronto sat Gaetan down for a talk. Gaetan at first denied he was having sex with anyone. His friend didn't let it end at that. He suggested to Gaetan that anyone with AIDS should stop having sex, period. Quote, "They can't tell me that having sex is going to transmit it," said Gaetan. "They haven't proved it yet." Quote, "Yes," his friend countered. "But if there's even the slightest possibility, then you shouldn't do it," end quote. "Yes, I suppose you're right," Gaetan shrugged. The friend wasn't sure that Gaetan agreed at all. He recalled the conversation they had had years before in Halifax, deciding whether they shouldn't hit the bars on the nights after they'd had shots for gonorrhea. the doctors always said to wait a few days, but Gaetan figured that since somebody gave it to him, he could give it right back. Quote, "This is incurable," Gaetan's friend pushed. "You don't just get a shot. It would be so incredibly unfair to give it to someone," end quote. "Yes," Gaetan said, "so unfair." Vancouver, British Columbia, November 1983. In Vancouver, Gaetan de Gas's health was beginning to fail. He had already defied all odds by surviving more than 3 years after his June 1980 diagnosis with Kaposi sarcoma. As his energy faded, he confided to friends that he was growing tired of the fight. Quebec City, Quebec, February 1984. His third bout with pneumocystis prompted Gaetan to move back to Quebec, where he could enjoy the care of his devoted family. They were constantly at his bedside, and Gaetan was in good spirits, but he wasted away to almost nothing and suffered from a perpetual fever. His friend, who'd come to visit, didn't think Gaetan would make it this time. The winter in eastern Canada was bitter cold. Gaetan complained, even as the first warm days of February were hitting British Columbia. Quote, "I am trapped in a dungeon where the guards wear white coats," he pleaded. "Please rescue me," end quote. Quebec City, Quebec, March 1984. Gaetan had survived his fourth bout with pneumocystis and appeared to be on his way to recovery. He spent much of late March on the telephone with friends in Vancouver, talking about how much he hated cold and dreary Quebec City and how he wanted to return to Vancouver. As always, Gaetan had managed to nurture a torrid love affair in his last months in Vancouver with a handsome male model. By the end of March, he persuaded the model to fly to Quebec and accompany him back to British Columbia. The model was on a plane east when Gaetan died in Quebec City. It was March 30th, a month past Gaetan's birthday, and it had been nearly 4 years since he had first gone to see the doctor in Toronto about the purple spot near his ear. At one time, Gaetan had been what every man wanted from gay life. By the time he died, he had become what every man feared. And the article notes, excerpted from the book And the Band Played On, People, Politics and the AIDS Epidemic by Randy Schultz. Now, amongst the timeline Randy Schultz laid out within his book that we've just heard extracts from, author and historian Dr. Richard McKay in 2017 published his book Patient Zero and the Making of the AIDS Epidemic. Now, I'll put links to both the books in the show notes and on the Extra Tea blog, but the blurb for the book states, McKay presents a carefully documented and sensitively written account of the life of Gaetan de Gas, a man whose skin cancer diagnosis in 1980 took on a very different meaning as the HIV/AIDS epidemic developed, and who received widespread posthumous infamy when he was incorrectly identified as patient zero of the North American outbreak. Now, Dr. Richard McKay had gone to great lengths to speak to those who personally knew Gaetan, including Ray Redford, a former acquaintance or lover of Gaetan, where Richard shared in his book, Patient Zero and the Making of the Epidemic, on a sunny, bitterly cold winter's day in late January 1982, Gaetan de Gas left his apartment in downtown Montreal to post a letter to Ray Redford, a former lover in Vancouver, with whom he remained friends. As he hurried through the snow-filled streets near the city's emerging eastern gay village, Dugas may have pondered the contents of the message he was sending, in which he had reflected on his recently troubled state of health. Dugas began his letter by complimenting Redford on his attractive new partner. Quote, "Obviously all the hot men are on the West Coast. He has beautiful eyes and an inviting moustache. Really handsome," end quote. He continued with words and spelling that hinted at his acquisition of English as a second language by providing his friend with an update on his health and thanking him for his concerns. Quote, "Well, my mind is finding peace again. Thank you for your encouraging letter. It is the best medicine so far. You are right, I must upgrade my attitude towards a full recovery, but, you know, there is always the storm that strike you when at least less expected," end quote. Evidently, Redford had asked in a previous letter some questions about, quote, gay cancer, end quote, based on an article he had read. Dugas noted that he could only have, quote, gathered very few informations off that article, end quote, but attributed this lack of knowledge to the generally poor level of research about the disorder. Quote, "It was writing by the only source they had," end quote. He added that he found taking vitamin A to be, quote, very good, so I overdose myself every day, end quote. Dugas thanked his friend for an invitation to visit him in Vancouver, adding, quote, I will hurry to grow my hair, even if you think I look better, end quote. Having shaved his head in anticipation of chemotherapy, Dugas felt self-conscious about his usually immaculate styled blonde locks, a fact that compounded his altered sense of self from being sick with cancer. Quote, I feel nude, he wrote, and too many people turn around when I walk in the city, he added. Quote, I feel like an alien, end quote, underlining this thought with a single stroke of his pen. Evidently, he drew a warm comfort from their correspondence. Quote, it is always a great pleasure to read you, end quote. Dugas confided, quote, and look forward to your letter, end quote. He ended the message by noting that he was waiting for the weather to improve so that he could visit his family who lived in a small community on the outskirts of Quebec City, quote, but as I speak to them regularly, my parents send you all their best wishes for this new year. Love and affection, Gaétan. Hug, kiss, hug. Oh, is it so nice to hear Gaétan's own words rather than some of, not all, but some of the tripe that Randy Schultz wrote, in my opinion, just my opinion. Anyhow, a year before Dr. Richard McKay published this book, Patient Zero and the Making of the AIDS Epidemic, the press reported on a scientific breakthrough that cast a degree of doubt on Gaétan Dugas being labelled as Patient Zero. Now, while many tabloids, particularly here in the United Kingdom, labelled Gaétan as a, quote, monster, end quote, amidst a slew of sensational headlines, more cautious publications, possibly motivated by legal considerations, often referred to Randy Schultz's assertions as merely, quote, claims, end quote. Furthermore, various professionals, including doctors, scientists, and representatives from gay groups, pointed out the inherent difficulties in assigning a single individual as the origin of a virus, an entity that remains fundamentally invisible to the human eye. And where this brief article in Glasgow's Herald newspaper here in the United Kingdom on the 27th of October 2016, gosh, it only seems like yesterday, it's almost 10 years ago, but it seems like yesterday, ran the headline, Experts Say Air Steward Blamed for Spread of AIDS Not Responsible for US Epidemic. Now, I don't mean to be rude, but you'd have to have been pretty thick to have believed it in the first instance. Anyhow, let's get back to the article, because they go on to report. An air steward blamed for starting the AIDS epidemic in the United States in the 1980s has been exonerated by scientists. Gaétan Dugas, a French-Canadian gay man, was posthumously labelled, quote, patient zero, end quote, and accused of being responsible for the spread of HIV and AIDS across North America. But new research shows he was simply one of many thousands of people infected with the virus in the years before HIV was recognised. Before he died, Dugas assisted investigators with a significant amount of personal information. This, combined with confusion between a letter and a number, contributed to the invention of, quote, patient zero, end quote, and the global definition of Dugas, according to historian Dr. Richard McKay. His findings and those of a US expert who genetically tested decades-old blood samples to map the early spread of HIV in America are published in the journal Nature. Genetic analysis of HIV taken from a 1983 blood sample from Dugas showed he was not even a, quote, base, end quote, case for strains of the virus prevalent at the time. A, quote, trail of error and hype, end quote, led to him being branded with the Patient Zero title, Dr. McKay maintained. The study led by scientists at the University of Arizona confirmed HIV, quote, jumped, end quote, from the Caribbean to the United States in around 1970. Then, this is the best bit, in 2019, the documentary film Killing Patient Zero, written by Laurie Lind and directed by Lind, presents a profound exploration of Gaétan Dugas, a figure entirely misrepresented in the history of the AIDS epidemic. And, following the insights provided in Dr. McKay's book, Patient Zero and the Making of the AIDS Epidemic, the film invites viewers into the lives of those who knew Gaétan intimately, including friends, lovers, and close colleagues that were more like family, from his time as an Air Canada flight attendant. So, Let's take a listen to some of Gaétan's Air Canada colleagues that were more like family from the amazing documentary film Killing Patient Zero. We get to hear from Pedro Lavague, Elaine Watson, Gaétan Ervig, and Richard Bisson. So let's take a listen.
We had a crew lounge where we had to check in all the time. And everybody was talking about Gaétan, how beautiful it was, and so on. So I was obviously curious to see. And one day I was in the comm center and I saw him, big smile, and we clicked right away. We were friends instantly.
I appreciated working with Gaétan because I didn't have to follow him around. I didn't have to say, well, you know, this is how we're supposed to do it. Why are you taking shortcuts?
Working for an airline was really a good home for gay guys, gay people, lesbian, because they were extremely, extremely good workers.
Of course, the airline, they were not blind to all this. They hired a lot of gay people. In fact, I would say at the time, it must have been at least 75%, 80% of the guys were gay.
Word was out, at least among the gay people, and probably even more around the straight people, that here was this, you know, outrageous gay guy, you know, who, well, outrageous gay guy.
Oh, yes, that was Gaétan's attitude. Yeah, like, you know, he doesn't have a problem about being gay. You do, so deal with it.
He even had his shirt adjusted tight, 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 which was not the airline rule. But he, you know, and his pants were so tight, you could see everything, basically.
I would say he was more than fairly and he was incredibly flamboyant.
He loved eyeshadows, a little bit of blue or purple, and he also had mascara.
How do you describe charisma, you know? But yes, he walked down the hall and you could see him stand out, you know? But he was very kind of, you know, he flowed.
But a great personality, you could tell right away, very smiling and joking right away.
Both of us, we used to color our hair the same color, and we'd do it on his couch watching The Young and the Restless.
I did get a white Corvette. Well, he said, oh, we must go for a ride, we must go for a ride. So we did. And you'd think that Gaétan would sit down in the passenger seat and that's it? No, he was sitting in the back the moment we got to Yonge Street, waving at the people. And I said, I don't care, you know. Everybody was laughing in a way or waving.
Actually, I've got copies of those pictures right here.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, I was wondering
so
if you
you see what? Gaétan in the white Corvette. My best friend that died from AIDS, Richard McDonald.
Yeah.
He's right there. He was with Gaétan at the time. Hairdresser in New Yorkville. The sweetest man, French-Canadian again. That was a good time because there was AIDS around at the time. I don't know, but there was no worry. We were having fun. Sliding his business card or they were coming from passengers.
Gaétan had said, did you notice the guy in such and such a seat? Cute. I bet you I can make more time with him than you can, which often was true.
This guy is definitely straight. There's no way Gaétan, well, you know, he's going to do anything with him. But the passenger goes, it was more important to have a party for him, obviously.
Oh, yes, he was an extremely sexual man. He was always ready, okay? He never knew. I was going to work, and he had his backpack. And there was something in the backpack, and it fell. So I said, oh, what's that? Oh, mon lubricant. I can't go anywhere without that. I'm sorry. So he picked it up right away and put it in his pocket. Like, was he sexual? I would say so.
I lost contact with Gaétan for a while. The moment he left for Vancouver, and I saw him once He was running through the terminal and we embraced and we chat, but he had very, very short hair at the time. He had a few spots on his face.
I thought it was very brave of him to still be working. He'd taken some time off and then he'd come back. I think that was, he came back for a last period. And when he did come back, he actually looked great. He was in a good mood, giggling like he always did, darling.
Gaetan was having trouble making it to flights, and he was booking off last minute because he was starting to feel too ill to work. More than anything, he wanted to keep flying. He didn't want to be booked off sick. He loved flying. That was his family. That was his freedom.
We didn't know who would survive this or who wouldn't survive this. It was possible that, you know, things were going to work for him. And so, consequently, I just met him in that spirit. And, you know, we both giggled. And as we were giggling, I just, you know, touched up his makeup because I could see that it hadn't been properly applied, you know. It was too cakey as well. I remember it being too cakey, more than not covering the lesion. He'd covered the lesion, but, you know, just a softer look. That was the last time I saw him. I didn't see him after that.
Oh, gosh, isn't it just so lovely to hear? And this is why Killing Patient Zero is an exceptional film that delves into the real life of Gaetan Dugas, told by those that knew him best, offering viewers an intimate portrait that contrasts sharply with the monstrous image perpetuated by media for almost three decades. It challenges preconceived notions and highlights themes of stigma, blame, and the human experience within the AIDS crisis, making it an essential and thought-provoking watch. There are so many more testimonies, so please do go check it out. Links to the film are in the show notes and on the Extra Tea blog, or you can simply search Killing Patient Zero on Prime or Apple TV or wherever you watch your films, but please do go check it out and have some tissues ready because I couldn't stop blubbering from start to finish. Not because it's entirely sad, but it just moves you that people have actually got wonderful, pleasant things to say about him because he wasn't the person that the media portrayed him as. And so just go check it out and have your tissues ready, darling. But more importantly, the film also includes testimony from those involved in the actual cluster study. Their accurate, scientific and heartfelt testimonies reveal a portrait of Gaetan not as a villain, but as a compassionate and vibrant individual whose story has long been overshadowed by stigma and misunderstanding. The emotional weight of their recollections elicit tears, not merely from sorrow, but from the beauty of remembrance and the need to reclaim his narrative by challenging the often one-dimensional, if not sometimes false perceptions of Gaetan's life. And in the film, the intricate science surrounding Gaetan's sequencing of HIV, alluded to in the article we read earlier from the Glasgow Herald, is unveiled. The scientists and doctors present factual accounts alongside original documentation from the study. And I'll try and share it briefly, but they illustrate how Gaetan was positioned at the centre of the spider graph, marked with an O, O for out of California. This labelling was misinterpreted by the CDC, America's Centers for Disease Control, who mistakenly read the O as a zero, leading to Gaetan being labelled as patient zero. Professor William Darrow, who conducted the cluster study, clarifies that Gaetan Dugas was actually referred to as Case 57, having been identified as one of the 56 men prior to Gaetan. Professor Darrow and others in the film expressed that Gaetan was incredibly eager to assist the cluster study, and in 1983, despite his declining health, Gaetan flew to the CDC in Atlanta to provide a significant deposit of blood for research purposes, just a year before his passing. And also shared in the film, as the Glasgow's Herald article that we heard earlier alluded to, scientists in 2016 analysed Gaetan's blood samples from 1983 to study the genetic sequencing of the strain of HIV present in Gaetan's blood, discovering that it belonged to the common subtype HIV-B, the same as mine. And while drawing on scientific techniques discussed in part 2 of the previous episode featuring David Carr, remember where Dr. Ho highlighted in 1995, that HIV is a virus that has one of the highest mutation rates, and that still stands to this day, that HIV mutates approximately 1% every year. meaning those analysing Gaetan's blood with modern advanced equipment found that his strain of HIV was of immediate age compared to other samples. Furthermore, researchers identified older strains predating Gaetan's, which substantiated that HIV had been present in America long before the strain of HIV that Gaetan had been infected with, thus ruling out the possibility of him being the original source. And remember the assertion from Randy Shield's book regarding Gaetan at the bathhouse, allegedly turning up the lights to highlight his Kaposi sarcoma and proclaiming he might have infected someone, seemed dubious to those hearing it, even us who were not present to witness the event or knowing Gaetan personally. Yet in Killing Patient Zero, Gaetan's friends, including Ross Murray, who Gaetan had been intimate with, along with his Air Canada colleague Pedro, reflect on the Gaetan that they knew and how the dramatic claims may have been more sensational than substantive. So, let's take a listen.
There was certainly a lot of fear because there was still a lot that was unknown about it. And so I had no idea what the impact was going to be on me as a result of having had sex with Gaetan. So we were just a group of us all had just gone out to a tea dance in the afternoon, and he was a friend of a friend of mine, and one thing led to another, and we ended up going home together. He was very full of life. He was charming. He just had a lot of fun, a lot of energy. Yeah, it was definitely risky. I bottomed for him. So a week after we had gone home together, I was talking with this mutual friend of ours, and I was saying, you know, he seemed like a really nice guy. And he said, oh yeah, he's got that weird gay cancer. And I was like, what gay cancer? I'd never heard of it. It was the first sort of time that anybody had even referenced something like that. And I sort of let it drop. And then I started to hear a little bit more about it. And then I started to see news about it. And so that became much more, again, embedded in my mind. And it was something that started to really impact my thought process. There was one part in the book where he was at a steam bath with someone, and at the end of their sexual act, he said, I've got gay cancer, and now you're going to get it too. And that struck me as very unlike the Gaetan that I knew.
Did Gaetan really knew he was spreading something? I can tell you one thing. If Gaetan knew that he was killing somebody by having sex with them, he would not have done it. He would have stopped having sex with whoever. If he knew exactly, no. That's not the person that I know. Gaetan was not like that. He was charming and everything, but very, very caring. No way, there's no way he would have continued this.
I didn't blame Gaetan. You know, had I become HIV positive, I never went through a period where I blamed Gaetan for that, because at that time, again, I don't think people really understood. And at the time as well, everything wasn't lumped into one thing. It was, you had Kaposi sarcoma and they were trying to figure out why some people had that. And you had PCP and they were trying to figure out why some people had that. And they hadn't connected all the dots yet that it was all one thing. So I don't think I ever went through a period where I blamed him.
Oh, common sense. I mean, who are you going to listen to? Are you going to listen to possibly somebody, if they even existed, that had this encounter with Gaetan at the bathhouse? Or are you going to listen to Randy Schultz, who never met or spoken to Gaetan Dugas? So we have it from two people that knew Gaetan personally. And I mean, did we really need confirmation that Gaetan would never have acted like that? Because, I mean, it sounded ridiculous anyway, reading it earlier. And also, if Gaetan was being deliberately reckless between 1980 to 1982, as Schultz and the media claimed, then Gaetan's attendance at the Vancouver AIDS Forum on the 12th of March 1983 appears contradictory. Why would someone seemingly cavalier towards safety take the time to engage in a discussion about a new gay disease? So, let's take a listen to several questions that Gaetan himself put to the panel.
we had at AIDS Vancouver discussed the fact that there was a man in town who was perhaps patient zero. And when a French-Canadian man got up and began asking very pushy questions, and by pushy I mean he asked questions about all the things for which there were no answers, and asked them in a way that kind of felt like pushing buttons.
So you shouldn't tell someone who has AIDS or have symptoms of AIDS, because there is no specific reason why you should get in contact with AIDS with infectious agent, like you mentioned. Like if you have a lover who has AIDS and you don't have AIDS, what is the warning you give to people? It seems like there's a kind of a fear towards those people here that who could have the symptom or if have the symptom or if have the disease, you should fear those people, but you should, you know, not necessarily fear those people.
My personal feeling about it is, and again, it can't be proved, is that some contagious agent is probably involved in the transmission of AIDS.
Oh, gosh, you know, it just none of it makes sense. You know, why would somebody being so careless and reckless, as alleged, you know, be really kind of getting involved and wanting to learn more about the disease and really kind of putting very tough questions? And in the film Killing Patient Zero, where segments of this clip do appear, they do share people that were there at the time that Gaetan was quite challenging.
The hepatitis vaccine, the new vaccine that is now offered to gay men, has been developed with gay men hepatitis, so therefore anyone who would receive such vaccine could be exposed to AIDS.
On the other hand, there's not one shred of evidence that this vaccine actually causes any syndrome like AIDS.
And I recall leaning over to Jeff Maines as moderator to say, please, if you don't get him off this microphone, he will undo any good we've done in the last hours.
If you think you may have, or you could be a concerned person with AIDS, if you present yourself to your doctor, what kind of test could you ask him to be undertaken in a manner to confirm if you are possibly a carrier or not?
If you are sick and you go to your doctor and you ask for tests, there are only certain limited ones he can do. He cannot check out whether or not you've been exposed to AIDS. That test simply does not exist.
This clip does appear in the film Killing Patient Zero, but in this instance, the clip was from Ribbon Community, formerly AIDS Vancouver, and their YouTube account. The full video is linked in the show notes and on the Extra Tea blog for this episode. Toronto-based documentary filmmaker Laurie Lind, behind Killing Patient Zero, was quoted as stating in one newspaper, quote, "He really should be thought of as a hero of the fight against AIDS."
The film is called Killing Patient Zero, and it's premiering at Hot Docs. Laurie Lind is the man behind it. He joins me now. Laurie, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The film is heartbreaking, and I watched it last night, so I'm fresh off viewing it, and I still feel enraged, and I feel tearful when I think of it. The story takes us through Gaetan's life, and he died from complications of AIDS in 1984, but was vilified for decades afterwards.
Yes.
Because of the AIDS epidemic. You say he should be called a hero. Why?
I do, because Gaetan Dugas participated in what was known as the cluster study. He gave information to the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, when they were trying to figure out, people forget, in 1982 and 83, they didn't have the name AIDS until 82, and they didn't know if it was sexually transmitted. So because Gaetan Dugas was able to give them the names of 72 men, unlike everyone else who could only remember like four or five, he was one of the first 40 cases, that helped them prove that it was sexually transmitted. So, and it's unfortunate because that cluster study, in it he was called Patient O from out of California. And in people reading Patient O, they thought it was a zero. And so all of a sudden he's called Patient Zero. And people misinterpreted that zero for the beginning, for the starting point of the epidemic, when at one point they wondered if he was the link between New York and California, and he wasn't even that. Subsequent science has proved that he was just one of thousands of men who were infected at the time.
Oh, and you can see that full interview on the Extra Tea blog. Link is in the show notes, along with links to the film Killing Patient Zero. So do go check it out. And the film Killing Patient Zero wasn't the first film around Gaëtan Dugas, because in September 1993, John Grayson, who is also one of the interviewees in the film Killing Patient Zero, released his musical Zero Patience. Zero Patience is a 1993 Canadian musical film written and directed by John Grayson, which challenges the myth surrounding the introduction of HIV to North America by framing it within a narrative that combines history and romance. The film centres on the character of Zero, who represents Gaëtan Dugas, often labelled as Patient Zero, and critiques the simplicity and harmful narrative perpetuated by media, notably in Randy Schultz's book, and the band played on. Set against a backdrop of vibrant musical numbers, the plot unfolds through an unlikely romance between the time-displaced explorer, Sir Richard Francis Burton, and the ghost of Zero, deftly intertwining themes of love, loss, and the pseudo-political implications of the AIDS epidemic.
Good evening. My name is Bert. Dick Bert.
Folks, this is the museum guy I was telling you about. Introduce yourselves.
My name is Michael. I've got Kaposi's. A lot of rage and a lot more scorn.
My name is Ross. T cell count 60. My sign is Capricorn.
I'm Ray. I've had hepatitis. Shingles, herpes, thrush, and PCP.
And George, I've got retinitis. I'm taking ZB0 for my CMV.
John Grayson's Zero Patience was massive. As us Brits would say, it was a massive up yours to all the crap that had been hurled at Gaëtan Dugas and anyone living with HIV/AIDS. Or, as Newark, New Jersey's The Star Ledger newspaper put it on the 7th of August 1993, after years of hemming, we'd do it if we could just find the right script. And hand-wringing, audiences don't pay out to get depressed, about the impossibility of creating viable entertainment, dramatic or otherwise, around the subject of AIDS. Audiences are about to be offered no fewer than four full-length projects with the epidemic at their epicentre. HBO's adaption of Randy Schultz's And the Band Played On, Jonathan Demme's Philadelphia from TriStar Pictures, Gramercy Pictures' release of the French drama Savage Nights, and the first AIDS musical, John Grayson's Zero Patience, distribution pending. Zero Patience has in common with Savage Nights any number of frank and politically incorrect depictions of sex. For starters, the title of Grayson's musical is a riff on Patient Zero, the French-Canadian airline steward who was once thought to have brought AIDS to North America and spread it around like Jiffy peanut butter. This latter-day Typhoid Mary, who also appears in And the Band Played On, is here as a ghost who returns to Earth via a bathhouse jacuzzi, has sex, protected, go figure, with 19th century explorer Sir Richard Burton, and this is one of Zero Patience's tamer conceits. Also certain to have tongues wagging is a musical interlude with singing rectums. It's fabulous, by the way, you got to see it. Which Grayson says was his way of bringing attention to the underpublicized role of anal sex in AIDS transmission. Quote, "You have to admit," Grayson says, "it's definitely a conversation starter," end quote. That segment, as well as one concerning a mellow-toned HIV virus, played by long-term survivor Michael Callan in drag, is also how Grayson scores points about the media's focus on scapegoats or questionable medical theories, from African green monkeys to Patient Zero, to the almost universal acceptance of the HIV virus as the sole or primary cause of AIDS, and dubious treatments, AZT, etc. Instead of following a more realistic route, Grayson says, quote, "I chose the musical form to make people listen in a new way," end quote. Oh, and it certainly did that, and I live with it. Anyhow, when I learned of Zero Patience being published in 1993, I asked myself, why did it take so long? And further, in the article, they ask the same question, where they state, "Zero and Savage Nights also take place in the mid-80s, a reminder of how long it has taken filmmakers to tackle this subject. Then, in August 1994, Zero Patience hits the MGM cinema in Piccadilly, London, where on the 28th of July 1994, Howard Feinstein of the Guardian newspaper speaks with writer and director John Grayson, where they ran the headline, "Back to Base Camp, Zero Patience, due to open in London, is a musical film about AIDS, which confronts prejudice through outrageous wit." And the article states, "A self-described movie musical about AIDS, Canadian film director John Grayson's Zero Patience, opens here next week at the MGM Piccadilly, but its playful butthole duet number bears little relationship to the MGM song and dance showstoppers of the 50s. The leading actors, John Robinson and Norman Fatu, wear plastic posteriors over their heads, revealing only teeth behind singing anuses."
"That makes me juvenile. I'm a polymorphous mess. Oedipus is weeping when my butt I do caress. I lie down and think of England. Toot that horn and bang that drum. It's an insult to the empire when I take it up the bum. Sex is not for queen and country. You don't need to rant and rave. Sodomy ain't so symbolic. Your rectum ain't a grave. Freud said we have a death wish. Getting buggered's getting killed. Is this ghastly epidemic something our subconscious willed? An asshole's just an asshole."
"The teeth freak me out a bit," says Grayson. "That's the sort of thing I love, doing something that can confront and shock but not alienate. People have to laugh," end quote. In New York for the weekend to work with collaborators on three new projects, the handsome, dark-haired, 34-year-old Torontonian wears tight denim cut-offs, boots and a white t-shirt covered by a funky black English waistcoat with fake flags and logos. Quote, "A gift from my ex," end quote. With a loving wink, Grayson has been making hilarious films and videos for 15 years that raise complex questions about serious and deadly topics. His mission is to rewrite gay history, to document legalized and illicit homophobia, and, in Zero Patience, to call into question fundamental medical and sociological assumptions about AIDS. His cinematic universe is light years away from the films about AIDS that have hit the commercial and festival circuits over the past decade. The safe, sappy melodrama of Philadelphia, the manicured sterility of Longtime Companion, the raw, aggressive anti-intellectualism of Greg Araki's The Living End, the downtown New York insouciance of Bill Sherwood's pioneering Parting Glances, or the home video immediacy of the haunting Silver Lake Life, The View From Here. Why did Grayson choose the musical format for Zero Patience? Quote, "The gay community has a very complicated historical relationship with the musical," he explains, "and nothing better expresses its love of camp. The musical offers a fabulous experimental film vocabulary that is also very accessible. The narrative can fragment and rupture. When you can take the subject of anal sex and put it into a duet, it becomes confrontational and easy to understand," end quote. Grayson also inserts occasional close-ups of explicit sex scenes. In the Papa Boner routine, three betoweled hunks from a chorus line at the Jet Set Baths.
"Oh look, he's popped a boner.
When you pop a boner in the shower, hoist it like a flag for all to see. Give us a good peek at your two messes. Be nonchalant, act naturally. When you cruise the hallways of a bathhouse, adopt the suave behavior of a vet. Every sex club has a code of manners. Observe these rules of bathhouse etiquette. Saunter by, wink, fiddle with your nipple. Puff your perfect pecs and swish your hips. Grab your basket cause you're going shopping. Then barge right in and kiss him on the lips. Yawning in the sauna is verboten. Giggling is considered trait du trait. And when you pop a boner in the shower, don't blush, be proud, display."
As in all film numbers, Grayson frequently shoots scenes from overhead, reminding one of Busby Barclay's defied kitsch, while it takes a formal jab at the hubris of the medical and scientific establishment. Oh, do you know, I hate reading big poncy words in these newspapers. The irreverent resurrection of historical figures is a favourite Grayson tool. Quote, "It's the interesting side of outing," he claims. "The conceit of zero patience is that 19th century English explorer and pseudoscientist Sir Richard Burton, played by Robinson, complete with long sideburns and Victorian attire, is a natural history museum curator in contemporary Toronto. While mounting an exhibition of plagues through the ages in the museum's Hall of Contagion, he encounters the ghost of Gaétan Dugas, played by Fatou, aka Patient Zero, the Air Canada flight attendant who achieved notoriety for supposedly bringing AIDS to North America. Originally part of a cluster study to prove the sexual transmission of AIDS, Zero was first vilified in And the Band Played On, the late Randy Schultz expose of government and scientific inaction in the face of the epidemic, and then in the media. An objective scientist, Burton at first shamelessly observes Zero in order to confirm the hypothesis and his guilt. Eventually, they become singing and dancing lovers. Quote, "It's unnecessary to create characters," says Grayson. "The world already has enough. Let's put the ones that are there back to work and give them new jobs. That includes digging up both real and fictional people. Whether it's Frida Kahlo or Gustav von Aschenbach from Death in Venice. To present gay history is to search for what is there but has never been talked about." End quote. In Zero Patience, Grayson transforms Burton in order to undermine the unquestioned authority of science. It's not that Grayson lacks respect for pure science. His retired father, an idealist, was head of the University of Western Ontario's Department of Botany. He's just disappointed when it mutates. Quote, "We should turn the spotlight on the practices of the medical and scientific establishment that have betrayed our trust," he says, "instead of scapegoating fags and junkies." End quote. He feels that Schultz and the press use the patient zero phenomenon to assign, quote, blame. "Why do we need a scapegoat?" he asks. Quote, "When they did the original study, they didn't know how long it took between infection and the onset of symptoms. By 1987, we knew it took a lot longer than 6 months. We're talking about a generation of young gay men who just weren't going to sit back and listen to the experts. They're saying, no, we want in on the decision making. We want full access to the information. We want to be in charge of our own lives and our own bodies. This has profound effects not just for AIDS, but for cancer, for the way that medicine is practiced. I hope that Zero Patience is contributing to the sort of larger critique of society that helps everybody, straight and gay, man and woman." End quote. It's loads of fun for everybody too. Now, before I could hunt down a copy of Zero Patience and before I watched it, I had gathered much of the newspaper coverage from the archives, where many of the reviews were mixed. Quote, "bizarre," end quote, was a term that was frequently employed, reflecting, I believe, a failure to grasp the nuances of camp gay humour, perhaps thrown in with a dose of homophobia as well. Living with HIV myself, I find that many of these discussions, especially in podcast episodes, tend to lean towards the melancholy. As I shared with the ladies at the HIV podcast, it is vital to engage with HIV/AIDS through a lens of humour, rather than solely sorrow. While the disease has undeniably caused profound grief and has claimed too many lives, the stigma surrounding it often thrives on this very atmosphere of doom and gloom. If we don't allow for a lighter narrative, we risk perpetuating the darkness and isolation that still looms over those affected. And despite my often dark sense of humour, even I, after watching Zero Patience, while enjoying it, found myself giggling, asking, what have I just watched? And I say that because it starkly contrasts with how we are typically conditioned to view HIV/AIDS and the narrative surrounding those who have succumbed to it and are currently living with it. As I mentioned earlier, the feelings it evoked were challenging to convey in the polished language often found in mainstream articles and reviews, but at its core it felt like a defiant kiss my arse and a bold up yours to societal nonsense perpetuated over the decades.
There's a
This audacity and irreverence struck a chord with me, sparking a desire to purchase merchandise. How do I track down John Grayson for a signed poster? It deserves to be showcased on stage, be it the West End or Broadway today, because I actually really quite enjoyed it for what it was. It was camp, and it was really was a great fuck you to everybody who was bleating on in some way that was contributing to the decades of stigma that still exists today. So I really enjoyed it. I loved it. And just like the spread of HIV/AIDS itself, zero patience once shown at the MGM cinema in Piccadilly, London, then spread to cinemas across the whole of the United Kingdom, reaching cities such as Southampton, Manchester, and even Sutton Coldfield. I have no idea where in the UK that is, but I'm sure it's lovely. John Grayson's Zero Patience transcended the cinema, with the film being aired on Channel 4. And this continued for a couple of years after, often after The Witching Hour. Then, on the 2nd of June 1995, the Independent newspaper wrote, 1994 was the same year that gay film directors Richard Glatzer and John Grayson gave us Grief and Zero Patience, two of the best films about AIDS, which also happened to be two of the funniest. In the first, a gay man contemplating suicide on the anniversary of his lover's death is overtaken by an absurd plot involving a courtroom soap opera, a photocopier repairman, and a semen-stained sofa. In the second, the search for Patient Zero, believed to be the man who first brought AIDS to America, is turned into an all-singing, all-dancing parable on the subject of scapegoating, with a cast that includes a Victorian sexologist, a vicious drag queen who goes by the name of Miss HIV, and a pair of love-struck singing sphincters. Neither the director of Grief nor the director of Zero Patience display much by way of tact, nor do they seem particularly concerned with avoiding humour. Zero Patience does end in anger, with a bunch of AIDS activists storming a museum, but even this is a cue for a show tune. Still, their purpose is deadly serious. By resisting these sentimental pieties evoked by a film like Philadelphia, films like these exist to remind us that there are more heartfelt responses to AIDS than group hugs and Kodak moments. Far from suggesting that, quote, AIDS is just another calamity to befall Mother Camp, end quote, what Grief and Zero Patience both demonstrate beyond all reasonable objection is that humour is part and parcel of how we cope with life's hard knocks, and that laughing in the face of AIDS isn't quite the same thing as treating it lightly. Gaytan's contribution to the scientific understanding of AIDS should not be underestimated. Numerous doctors, professors and scientists have acknowledged his cooperation, with Professor Darrow highlighting in the film Killing Patient Zero that if all participants in the cluster study had matched Gaytan's level of helpfulness, insights and understanding into this emerging new virus could have been gained much more swiftly. There is a great irony that our understanding of Gaytan Dugas, a pivotal figure in the narrative of AIDS, arose from the misrepresentation orchestrated by Randy Schiltz in his expose. While many acknowledge that Schiltz's intentions were commendable, aiming to thrust the AIDS epidemic into the spotlight of the United States government, the means by which he did so have faced criticism. But with science eventually clearing Gaytan's name in 2016, if ever such proof was needed, no longer makes Gaytan Dugas patient zero, but for the whole scientific community and the HIV/AIDS community, gay or straight, Gaytan Dugas is now patient hero. You can check out and read all the newspaper articles mentioned in this episode, along with extra snippets of information, on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, then don't forget to like, share and subscribe. Until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at The Lost Boys of Soho.